The Tom Woods Show, episode 2174.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, if you've decided it's best not to have your kids educated by people who have declared war on you, then consider the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. Instructors like me will give your kids an unfair advantage and an education you and I could only have dreamed of. But make sure you join through my link, because only there do you get my $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. All right, we are getting very close to back to school period for those of you in traditional schools. So this seems like an appropriate moment to release for you the final one of these for the year. And that is, I'm going to play for you another of my lessons from the Ron Paul curriculum. And this one, it's almost like I said to myself, let me see the most obscure topic I can possibly cover and put it out there on the podcast. And I'm doing it. But obscure doesn't mean boring, okay? It means you learn it, you really, really impress your friends, okay? And so our topic today, of all possible things, is Hellenistic philosophy. Now, by Hellenistic, we're talking about Greek culture during a particular period, as Greek culture begins to spread through the Mediterranean into Asia and the Near East. This is round about the time from the death of Alexander the Great up until round about the end of the first century BC. That's the Hellenistic period. And I'm talking in this particular lesson about various philosophical schools. And I personally find it interesting that thousands of years ago, people are talking about things that are, I wouldn't say the same as the issues that we're talking about now, but some of the big picture questions they're talking about are, in fact, in some ways, when you get right down to the fundamentals, quite similar. For example, what does it mean to say that man should live according to nature? What does that mean? Does that mean man should just do what comes naturally? Does that mean something else? It could mean man has a nature and he should live in a way that will contribute to his flourishing, to the full realization of that nature. Well, in a way, that's kind of the backbone of a lot of conversations that we have right now, whether you realize it or not. And they're wrestling with this during the Hellenistic period. So if you like this kind of thing, if you like Western civilization, I teach it with the Ron Paul curriculum. And it is the biggest course because it's split into two. Most people, if you take a Western Civ course in school, it's a year. Mine's 2 years. Okay, so you are going to learn so much Western civilization. It's going to be seeping out of your various orifices. There's going to be so much Western civilization packed into you. And I present it in a way that I think is fairly engaging, but also contains a lot of information. Guess what? You're not going to learn anywhere else. So if you'd like to have my Western civilization courses, there are multiple ways to get them, multiple ways. Some of them are as free bonuses, actually. So they're all laid out for you. All your options for getting these courses are laid out for you on the show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/2174. Here we go. Hi, everybody. It's Tom Woods, and it's time for our second lesson on the Hellenistic period. First, we'll review what we covered last time. Last time, we introduced the word Hellenistic and explained what it means. The Hellenistic world, this term Hellenistic, was actually coined relatively recently, just in the 19th century AD. And it's a term used to refer to the period of history from 323 BC, which is an important date because that's the death of Alexander the Great, and 30 BC, which is the date of the death of Cleopatra VII. She's a figure we will look at in a later lesson. The word Hellenistic, though, doesn't just refer to this period in history. We also use the word Hellenistic to talk about the kingdoms that succeeded Alexander. Alexander's territory could not all be held together after his death. All that territory that he conquered, it was simply too far flung for any one person to govern it all. So it wound up being divided. And we refer to these divisions as Hellenistic kingdoms. We noted that Alexander's generals wound up fighting among themselves until finally it was decided that no one of them would be able to rule everything. And the result was the division into Hellenistic kingdoms that we saw last time, and I showed you a map. And I noted that these generals, they didn't necessarily have any roots in any of these countries or any type of legitimacy from the point of view of
being related to any ruling family from the past or anything. They were simply ambitious, strong men who took over. We also noted that the term Hellenistic refers to a kind of meeting of cultures that takes place. Because as Alexander moved from west to east, he was leaving behind him settlements that attracted a lot of Greek settlers who would bring with them their customs and their culture. And in this way, Greek culture is going to diffuse itself all throughout Egypt and Asia Minor and in other places. And it's this meeting of cultures, the introduction of Greek culture in some area, but it will blend in one way or another with existing culture. And the result is Hellenistic culture. So the whole period is referred to as Hellenistic. And last time we looked at some of the achievements of this period. Sometimes this period is disparaged a lot of times in Western civilization presentations because it's like historians are impatient. They've finished up the Greeks. They want to get going with the Romans. So let's hurry up and talk about these few centuries really quickly so we can hurry up and start the unit on Rome. And that's not entirely fair because although we do see a degeneration, for example, in literary output or in drama, nevertheless, there is important and significant scientific work that's done. And there is important philosophical work that is done as well. And the art is also very good throughout this period. We looked at the Laocoon last time as an example, and we saw that the old staid and a very much restrained style of the classical period has now given way to a much more ready depiction of turmoil and emotion and tragedy, which becomes a characteristic feature of Hellenistic art. So we did review, I was about to go on, but I forgot to mention, we reviewed some of the scientific achievements. So we talked about Hippocrates and the Hippocratic Corpus, and we don't know if he wrote it or not, but whoever wrote it is a significant figure because it covered so many areas involving medicine, the doctor's craft and his responsibilities, and how to diagnose diseases, how to treat them, how to prevent them. And then we noted that some of the successors of Hippocrates in the Hellenistic period went even beyond this and expanded our medical knowledge by means of, for example, vivisection and live dissection. In fact, it seems at least possible that these medical figures were dissecting living human beings, which is not something that maybe we find morally acceptable. But all the same, it indicates something of the spirit of inquisitiveness that was going on. Then we talked about figures you're likely to encounter in any textbook treatment of the Hellenistic period. Eratosthenes, the guy who, among many other things, calculated fairly successfully the circumference of the earth, which, by the way, goes to show that everybody understood that the earth was a sphere. Okay, this idea that everybody was too stupid and they all thought the earth was flat is not true. So he's calculating the circumference, obviously, of a sphere. So we'll have more to say about that, about the flat earth myth, when we get up to Columbus. It's not true that people were worrying that Columbus was going to fall off the edge of the earth. That's just all crazy nonsense. Nobody was warning Columbus of that. Then we talked about Hipparchus with the development of trigonometry and the longitude and latitude system and other achievements there. Aristarchus with the heliocentric model that the earth is rotating and then revolving around the sun. Euclid, the great practitioner of geometry with his elements, a very, very, very influential mathematical work. Then finally, Archimedes with his many achievements and many interests and interesting stories. So today, what I want to do is introduce to you some of the schools of thought that developed during the Hellenistic period. There are a good many of them, and only a couple of them will be of long-lasting significance, and those are the Stoics and the Epicureans. The Stoics are going to be influential for probably 500 years, and the Epicureans, like the Stoics, today, we have a word Epicurean, and we have a word Stoic in the English language, and we use them in ways that more or less reflect the philosophies of these schools. So I think it's good to be aware of them. So here they are: skepticism, cynicism, Stoicism, and Epicureanism. So I may not do them quite in that order. Let's see how I feel as we go along. Let's start first with skepticism. According to the skeptics, a skeptic is somebody in philosophy who is unsure that truth can ever really be known. Like today we say somebody's skeptical, we don't usually mean that the person is as skeptical in such a thoroughgoing way as the actual philosophical school called skepticism was. The skeptics were people who believed that the human mind was basically incapable of grasping truth, even if truth existed. So even if we could say there's a truth, the human mind can't grasp it. So there may as well not be a truth. And perhaps the best known of the skeptics is a guy named Pyrrho, P-Y-R-R-H-O, who was born around 360 BC. And Pyrrho held that basically nothing can be known with certainty. We human beings can never attain certainty. And so therefore, what will the wise man do? In light of this realization that he can never be certain about anything, what will the wise man do? Will he be troubled by this? Will he spend his time vainly and desperately seeking after knowledge? No, the wise man will simply suspend judgment and seek a peaceful life instead of bothering about a truth he can never reach. And what was also concluded by the skeptics is that since we can't know the truth, the best thing to do is simply adopt whatever practices in society are customary and traditional. In other words, you can't know what's true and what's false and what's right and what's wrong. So why don't you just do what everybody else is doing? You know, don't rock the boat. Just be part of society. Do what everybody else is doing. Try to lead as pleasant a life as possible. And don't trouble yourself about these big questions that an Aristotle or a Plato or a Socrates might have tried to answer. It's pointless to bother. There are no answers. There is no truth. Don't bother. Just enjoy yourself. Just live a peaceful life the best you can. That was the school of skepticism. Then we have this interesting school called the cynics, cynicism. The cynics take the view that one should live according to nature. That's an important phrase to bear in mind because there are a lot of philosophers and a lot of philosophical schools who will tell you that the best approach to life is to live according to nature. But what do they mean by that? That's the question. What do they mean, live according to nature? The Stoics will mean something different from what the cynics meant, and the cynics mean something different from what Aristotle meant when he would say that we should take our cues from nature. What do they all mean? Well, the cynics basically meant by live according to nature, do what comes naturally. Do what comes naturally. So don't worry about the proper behavior, proper customs. Just do what you want to do and do what you want to do in public, even if it's something that we might think ought to be done behind closed doors. Just do what you want. Forget about the conventions of society that tell you you should do this, you shouldn't do that. We defy these. So for example, the cynics engaged in what's sometimes called free love, or they avoided marriage. Marriage is a traditional institution, and I don't necessarily feel like doing it. So I'm not going to do it. So they avoided that. Truth, they believed, was elusive. It was very difficult, if not impossible, for human beings to grasp. So just, again, do what comes naturally. Now, the person who is most frequently associated with cynicism is not the founder of cynicism, but rather a man named Diogenes. Now, there are a lot of stories associated with Diogenes, and it's hard to know whether they're true or not, but they do illustrate various aspects of Diogenes' character. For example, he would eat raw meat. He tried to eat raw meat because cooking is unnatural. It's not according to nature. So in that sense, he's talking about do things that are natural that don't involve artificial contrivances either. One of the stories that we associate with Diogenes is he thought it was in some ways silly to be preoccupied with these abstract philosophical questions. And one day, the followers of Aristotle were in the Lyceum, the school, and on the other side of the wall, they're outdoors, and on the other side of the wall, Diogenes is listening into their conversation, and they're trying to define what a human being is. They're trying to come up with a definition that would account just for human beings and apply only to human beings and no other creature. So the definition they came up with was a human being is a featherless biped. A biped, of course, is a creature that walks on two legs. So a dog, for example, is not a biped. Human being is a biped. But a bird or a chicken would also be a biped. They walk around on two legs. So to distinguish a human being from a bird or a chicken, they referred to a human being as, or defined a human being as, a featherless biped. So then some laughter was heard on the other side of the wall. That's Diogenes. And he shouts, "Here's your man." And over the wall, he throws a plucked chicken. There's a featherless biped. So the followers of Aristotle had to come up with a new definition. I mean, that's sort of an oddball thing to do. Another thing associated with Diogenes is he lived on top of a hill. He lived inside a bathtub that he never filled with water. And sometimes Some of the cynics didn't bathe, right? This is an artificial convention. Why should I conform to it? So there is a, I don't want to say that no hippies ever bathed. I'm not looking to insult anybody here, but there is a kind of aspect of the hippie in the cynics in that they defy normal conventions of society. They live their own way. And so one day, the story goes that Alexander the Great himself said, I have got to meet this man, Diogenes, that I've heard so much about. I've just got to meet him. The story goes that Alexander goes up to the bathtub and where Diogenes is lying there getting some sun. And Alexander stands over him and says, you know, this is, it's incredible to meet you. And you're such an extraordinary and fascinating person. I'll give you anything you want, up to including half of my kingdom. What can I give you? What do you want from me? And Diogenes simply said to him, get out of my sunlight. That was his answer. So that's an odd thing. It's not a school that a lot of people are going to follow, but it is interesting because of the idea of living according to nature so that you understand there are different ways to interpret this phrase. Because certainly other philosophers are not going to mean by live according to nature, do whatever comes naturally. I'll point out that if we were to ask Aristotle, what do you mean by live according to nature? He wouldn't mean do whatever comes naturally because virtue does not come naturally. Virtue is something learned. Virtue is something you have to practice. Virtue does not come naturally. He wouldn't have had to write, wouldn't have written the Ethics if it did. So what does he mean, live according to nature? What Aristotle would have meant was look and figure out what your nature is. Figure out what your purpose is. What is the end? What is the goal of a human being? Well, it's what is your prized possession? Your reason, your ability to reason and think. So you should live according to that. That's your nature. You should live in a way in which reason is given the greatest possible expression. You shouldn't live where you're eating raw meat and doing stuff like that. That's silly. Live according to nature means live according to your nature. Live according to the essence that you have been created to fulfill, to live according to. That's what it is. Your nature is to be a rational being. So live according to nature means live according to that archetype of who you are, namely your rational nature. Then we have, do I want to do Stoicism? No, I'm going to insert another school here. Here's a school you don't have to write down. I didn't even put it on the slide. That's how much I don't want you to worry about. I don't even want you to be able to spell it. I didn't even put it on the slide. But I put it there because I do want to talk about the Epicureans. And the Epicureans are sometimes confused with this other school. And so I don't want you to worry about them. This other school is called the Cyrenaics. The Cyrenaics were led by a guy named Aristippus. And Aristippus held the view that the best way to live, we see that the skeptic's view is just live a pleasant life because there's no way to know the truth about anything. The cynic's view was do whatever comes naturally. The Cyrenaic's view is going to be do whatever brings you the most physical or sense pleasure. Pleasure, physical pleasure is the highest aim you should be shooting for. And so Aristippus, it is with him that we associate the philosophy that we sometimes hear expressed in the phrase or in the admonition, let us eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. That's what the Cyrenaics believed. Pleasure. Well, people think, if you were to ask somebody today, a reasonably educated person, what did the Epicureans believe in the ancient world? What was the Epicurean philosophy all about? And they will say, well, they were all about pleasure. They were hedonists. Well, the Cyrenaics were hedonists. A hedonist is somebody who is concerned exclusively with pleasure. And the Epicureans were indeed hedonists, but they were not hedonists in the way that the Cyrenaics were, because the Epicureans actually had good responses to the Cyrenaics. The Epicureans said, if what you're after is pleasure, you're not going to get there by just going out getting drunk every night, because what happens to you the next morning? Do you call that pleasure after your drinking binge? You call that pleasure? Yeah, you can stuff yourself, eat all the food you want. How are you going to feel after that? You call that pleasure? Yeah, you can go out and have romantic affairs with a whole bunch of people, but you are going to be an emotional train wreck by the end of that. That's not how you bring about pleasure. So the Epicureans were a school that said that, yes, we should aim at pleasure, but we should aim at it intelligently. And we should understand there are different types of pleasures. Pleasures vary in intensity. They vary in duration. So a lot of the pleasures that the Cyrenaics are aiming at are very fleeting pleasures, like that bite of lasagna in your mouth. It's wonderful, but within 2 seconds, it's gone. That's a fleeting pleasure. Whereas the Epicureans were aiming more at more lasting pleasures. The pleasures of the mind, although they're not as intense as the pleasures of the sense, they're longer lasting and they're less likely to harm you or bring you pain. So listening to music or a good concert or enjoying a good book or listening to a homeschool presentation or any of these sorts of things that you enjoy intellectually will bring you longer lasting pleasure. Friendship will bring you a deeper pleasure and a longer lasting pleasure than stuffing your face will, which is only going to bring you grief in the end. If you think that reaching after pleasure by just getting drunk and overeating and indulging all your appetites, then you are the worst hedonist ever, because all you're going to bring on yourself after those fleeting pleasures is pain and suffering. So Epicureanism was a school of thought that got started with a man named Epicurus, who lived from 341 to 271 BC. And so, yes, he does believe you should live for pleasure, but these pleasures should not be found in the sorts of base activities that often leave us unhappy, the life of the drunkard, the life of the libertine. It's better to pursue a simple life seeking freedom from pain and peace of mind. That's what the Epicureans teach. And let me read to you from Epicurus. He said, "The pleasant life is produced not by a string of drinking bouts and revelries, nor by the enjoyment of boys and women, not by fish and the other items on an expensive menu, but by sober reasoning." And he said, "It is not possible to live pleasantly without living prudently, honorably, and justly, nor to live prudently, honorably, and justly without living pleasantly." So you see, I don't necessarily recommend Epicureanism to you. I'm not endorsing or condemning it, but surely it's unfair to conflate Epicureanism with Cyrenaicism, which clearly was just talking about sense pleasures. And indeed, friendship and rational reflection were among the great pleasures for the Epicureans. They also held the view that the universe was meaningless. If there are gods, the gods do not care for mankind. And so that means you should, again, this is a way to live your life free from worry. Don't worry about the gods. They're of no import to you. The universe also, according to the Epicureans, was entirely material. There was no immaterial realm. It was all matter. It was all physical stuff. So here he's following the pre-Socratic atomists. He's following people like Democritus, who said that the universe is all just atoms. It's all just physical atoms. There's nothing beyond the physical in the world. There is no immaterial realm. All those immaterial things Plato pointed to, none of those exist. Now, Democritus and the atomists, though, took that view and drew from it its logical conclusion. If all the world is just atoms colliding, then everything in the world is determined, including you. You have no free will. You might feel like you're making choices, but you don't have any say in the matter. Your choices are the result of just some atoms bouncing around in your head, which force you to perform the actions and move around and make decisions the way you do. You have no free will. All you are is just some matter. You have no more free will than a washing machine would have or than a glass of water would have, because really, fundamentally, you're no different from those things. A glass of water is just atoms bouncing around, and your brain is just atoms bouncing around. So the decisions you feel like you're making, you're not really making decisions. You're just doing what you're programmed to do by the atoms that are bouncing around. Well, Epicurus couldn't follow that. He said, yes, all of the universe is just material, but then he jumped out of that for a minute and said, but we have free will. And he didn't really try to reconcile these things. Then finally, we have the Stoics. Now, the Stoics we associate today with the word Stoic. So somebody who's Stoic is just emotionless. You can't perturb this person. No matter what happens to him, you can't get him to worry. Stoicism, we divide it into three periods. They're the early Stoa. The early Stoic philosophers, beginning with Zeno, who lived from 342 to 270 BC. Then we have the middle Stoa, most of whose writings are lost to us. And then the later Stoa, who would be people like Seneca, people like Marcus Aurelius in the late 2nd century AD. And the doctrine does develop over time. The later Stoics are different in some ways from the earlier Stoics. The earlier Stoics seem to suggest that all of the universe is divine. They seem to be pantheists. Whereas the later Stoics, they may be talking about a personal God. Whereas the early Stoics think everything is God. We're all in one divine cosmic order. Now, the writings of even the early Stoics really exist to us only in fragments, if we have them at all. But what we can get from it is that individual virtue is the key principle. And living according to nature for them means recognizing that you live in a universe where there is some plan built in it, and that plan is going to be realized. It's going to come to fruition, whether you like it or not. And that plan may involve some suffering for you. But since there's nothing you can do about that, if suffering comes your way, there's no point in getting worked up about it. Live according to nature means go with the flow. If life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. Reconcile yourself to the fact that I can't control the destiny of the universe. So whatever happens, happens. And what I should try to do is live my life, try to conform myself to the divine plan of the universe to the best extent that I can figure it out. And the best way to do that is to cultivate individual virtue in myself. So therefore, I need to withdraw myself from emotion and irrational impulse and just accept whatever comes my way with calmness and serenity. Serenity now, in other words. So I accept pain and pleasure with indifference. And no matter what happens, as long as we have our virtue, no matter what we're deprived of, we still have that that can make us content. The Stoics' universe was rational and orderly and determined. It had a purpose, but that purpose was determined. There's no way you could change it. But if you live according to virtue, you are cooperating with the divine plan. That's about all you can know. And that's what goodness is. The Stoics, as time goes on, as I say, it becomes a little more ambiguous. Do they maybe believe in a personal God? Well, if so, they did believe that this God, whoever or whatever it was benign, was good, and did care about mankind. And they looked at the popular religion of people around them, of the average person, and they tolerated that. And they tried to reach out to those people through allegory and say that, well, what you believe in your popular, you know, more superstitious kind of religion is kind of an extension of what we believe. It just in sort of a cruder form. It has an analog in what we believe. But that's basically the Stoic view, that you should simply be as unperturbed as you can. You know, take things like a man. So even if a family member should die, you should accept that as just part of the plan of the universe and be emotionless. And when we get to later lessons, when we're talking about the later Stoics, I'm going to give you examples of Stoics who did exactly that. Your daughter just died. Oh, well, she wasn't going to live forever. And that's not really the way a normal person would react. So all these philosophical schools that we've talked about here were not really super popular with the average person. The average person would find these very remote and distant from himself. And really, they were philosophies that the elite might grasp onto, but by no means did a majority of people accept any of this. What a lot of people did start drifting toward, though, in the Hellenistic period were the mystery religions. You had a lot of people who were uprooted from their homes for economic reasons, moving around in the world. And so they didn't feel the connection that they used to the public religion of their city. And as the Greek city-states began to deteriorate because they weren't independent anymore and they were the playthings of other powers, the idea of the public religion dedicated to the gods of the city began to fall away. And in its place, we began to see a more private religion focused on the individual, not on your city, but on you. And so what people began to do was, as they had less connection emotionally to their cities, they began to be more interested in finding religious fulfillment, not in the ritual observance of their city, but in these individualistic religions. I use the word cult. That's a technical term. It doesn't mean cult like cults that you read about in the newspaper. It just means a center of religious devotion. And so the mystery religions are aimed more at you as an individual, not at you as an Athenian, not at your city, but at you. And each of these mystery religions, there was a mysterious sacred drama involved in it. And you prepared to be initiated into it by offering sacrifices, eating certain food, engaging in certain ascetic practices. Asceticism means self-denial. And then you would be initiated and you would be assured of your acceptability before the God and assured of your eternal happiness. So these are the types of philosophical schools and religious practices that are going to flourish and are going to be around at the time that Christianity will come into the world. So these are the sorts of different kinds of ways of thinking with which the Christian religion will one day have to reckon. Okay, that's it for today. See you next time.
All right, everybody, that's going to do it for today. Tomorrow, we have a tax advisor coming on, and we're going to talk about what we can do to keep the tax man's hand from going too deep into the pocket. Now it sounds like I'm talking about the TSA. But anyway, you're not going to want to miss that. So I will see you all tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.